Pod's Pod This. My name is Andy Moore. Friends, it's good to be with you again this week. I'm sorry, I missed last week. I was out of town. I was in transit, actually, on Friday, and I thought I might record from the airport in Phoenix, and that was not to be had. Could not find a quiet corner to save my life. And there was, like, you know, delays. Flying in the modern world is a far cry from what it was in the 60s. Not that I was around, but I've seen, you know, reports on it. Anyway, as it turns out, the last couple of weeks have been quite busy, so let's catch up a little bit. Perhaps most notably is that this week the state legislature formally announced and passed their budget deal. I guess they really announced it last week, but we'll catch up. The budget deal for the new fiscal year 2026 clocks in at $12.6 billion. Now, the total state budget is more than that. There are several billion dollars that come off the top that the legislature can't touch. And that's for a variety of reasons. That's a whole other podcast to get into that. But of the $12.6 billion that the legislature is appropriating, in general, it holds most state agencies flat. Small increase to public education, like about 3%, which comes out to about $120 million, I think. And then there's some cuts to career tech. Career tech saw about a 9% cut. Ironically, the public school funding formula, which is part of the public education piece, received $25 million, and then career tech had their workforce development program cut by $28 million, which really seems like in this budget, then the legislature is willing to help ensure that kids get a better education, but not help them get good jobs when they graduate. Once again, I think our budget system inherently picks winners and losers somewhat arbitrarily year to year. And it's more of a, we tend to like flip flop on who gets money when. And that is very difficult for any agency to like build or sustain or develop programs for the future, and we need to be thinking about the future, right? Now, I know we have, I think, mentioned in the past some one-time requests, and those were included in the budget as well. OU received $200 million for a new pediatric hospital. OSU received $250 million for a new College of Veterinary Medicine. The state is using about $312 million to purchase this private prison in Lawton. I don't know a whole lot about that. That kind of, to me, came out of nowhere from the governor just in the last few weeks. So it's something we'll certainly be watching more closely. And then there's an additional $42 million to the National Guard for some maintenance and modernization of their facilities. These are all one-time costs, and they used one-time monies to pay for it, which kind of makes sense. Like, sometimes you need a big lump sum to do something, right? Like, you got to fix the, you know, at your house, you got to fix the sewer line, or you got to something. You got to spend a lot of money at once, replace the hot water tank. That's this kind of stuff, but on a state level. The budget also gives the Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services an additional $26 million in a supplemental appropriation, although it turns out that might not actually be enough for them to meet their budget hole. It also does some really interesting things with taxes, and this is the part that's, of course, getting the headlines. under Governor Sitt's plan here, it reduces the number of tax brackets from 6 to 3, and so it eliminates the 3 lower tax brackets. And I think that means that some low-wage workers or low-income households will actually pay less in taxes, but it also or paid less or even no in state income tax, but at the top end, the state's top income tax bracket will actually be cut. So the wealthiest among us also get a tax cut. It's going to reduce that from it's going to reduce it by 0.25%. So currently it's 4.75%. It's going down to 4.5%. functionally, though, it's not that big of a deal for most of us, right? Most households will save less than $150 a year, which is like $3 a week. The governor called this very significant. I disagree. Saving $3 a week is probably not even noticeable to most households. I was texting somebody yesterday and I said, if I save up my entire tax cut savings for next year, I could buy one ticket to the Thunder game for Saturday, like at a discount even, right? Not even enough money for one Thunder ticket. It's not enough money for even 1 gallon of gas, honestly. So you can buy, this will save you the money to buy 1 gallon of gas per week, which is negligible. One cup of coffee, whatever, however you want to frame it. Although a cup of coffee is not $3 anymore most places. The governor has said openly, right, that his goal is to end the state's personal income tax, even though it accounts for a huge chunk of our state's general revenue fund. He has not really said how that's supposed to be made up, compensated for. So if we eliminate the personal income tax, then there's this giant budget hole. This tax cut alone, right, he is saying it's going to cost the state about $160 million this first year. But then the next year, it'll cost more on the order of $400 million. Well, that's a big chunk of change. And this is just a reminder, that's how taxes work, right? Each of us pays a small amount in, and we pool all of that money together, and then collectively, we can make some really big changes, right? Just like if you are, trying to have a pizza party in the office. Nobody individually wants to pay for the whole pizza party, but if you all, pitch in $3, okay, now we can buy enough pizza for the whole place. That's really how taxes work. It is a group project, but it requires group participation. The other problem with this tax plan is that it relies on an economic trigger. That is, like, when the economy grows a certain amount, that trigger kicks in and triggers additional cuts. So this is how his, like, pathway to zero income tax is going to work. That if the economy keeps growing, we'll cut the rate so people pay less and less and less. Now, the thing about that, though, is that we've been here before. Heck, Let's Fix This started in 2016 because of the dire impact of a trigger bill not unlike this one that they had passed several years before that. So the legislature has passed similar tax cut trigger bills twice before, and both times it led to a financial crisis for our state, and both times the legislature had to come back in a few years later and repeal the tax cut. So this is Governor Stitt trying to hang his hat on the fact that he cut taxes and created a pathway to zero income tax, and I will bet you dollars to donuts that within 10 years we have to come back and fix this because it's going to result in a continued diminishing of income to our state, or they're gonna have to find ways to make up this growing budget hole, and that's probably gonna come in the form of some other tax or of fees somewhere, in how we like do things. Like the cost of driver's licenses is gonna skyrocket. They're gonna reinstitute, vehicle inspections and the costs with it. Something they're gonna have to find a way. Now, the budgetary agreement package also includes some non-budgetary policy changes, including the creation of business courts, a proposed change to the state's workers' comp system that would put a cap on damages for pain and suffering. This is a really big deal. One of my first memories of Oklahoma politics when I was kind of paying attention and getting involved was about workers' comp. And they passed a cap on this stuff before, and it was deemed unconstitutional. Ultimately, the court said that you can't limit how much you pay people who like got injured at work but survived versus those who got injured at work and died from the same injury. That if there's an injury, you have to pay the same amount either way, regardless of whether they lived or died, which kind of makes sense. It's not the outcome that matters. It's really how it happened and who's responsible for it. So we'll see what happens here. Should this get signed into law, and I'm certain it will, it'll likely be challenged in court at some point. And then we'll have to wait and see. And I feel like I have to say that way too often. There are so many things the legislature passes every year that they know is blatantly or likely unconstitutional, and they're just like, well, we'll just pass it and see what happens. And that is putting a lot of hope in our courts. That is also, I would argue, the legislature giving away power to the courts to decide things that it's not necessarily their role and like how they were set up. A recent audit, although it's not really an audit, but a recent analysis of the Department of Mental Health budget from David Greenwell, who's a CPA, a certified public accountant, and a former member of the Oklahoma City City Council as well. But he was brought in to DMH to kind of do an analysis of like what is actually happening right now and how much money do they really need this year. He was very clear this is not an audit. This is a best effort projection with a reasonable margin of error using historical data and trend analysis. Great. Okay. So that's not an audit. It's like, here's what we think is happening. We're doing some projections. This is what we think we are right now. And basically it said, okay, they need $30 million for this year. You know, a few weeks ago, just a few weeks ago, the head of ODMH said, well, we only need, first she said we need $63 million. And she's like, oh, just kidding. It's probably $43. Oh, no, just kidding. It's only six. And even the legislature was like, I don't believe you. And they were like, oh, maybe it's 28. Okay, well, turns out it's 30. In addition to that dollar figure, which is helpful to know, Mr. Greenwell made several recommendations, 52 other recommendations, including things that are kind of low-hanging fruit. Like he recommended that the department hire a chief financial officer and an internal auditor with deep public sector experience. Yeah, we need those because both of those people just quit in the last couple of weeks. They also need to update their accounting system to one that's approved by the Office of Management and Enterprise Services, OMES. And I was shocked to read that because that means that they haven't been using an accounting system approved by OMES, which begs the question, what have they been using? Has the Department of Mental Health just been operating on Microsoft Excel spreadsheets all this time? They have a total budget of like $700 million. You need something more advanced than just spreadsheets and like a bucket of receipts on your desk. Lots of other stuff. It's an interesting report. If you're interested, you can find it. I think it's linked in a KOSU story if you go on their website. It's probably linked elsewhere as well. Another important thing that happened is a bill from last year, House Bill 4156, which was authored by then Speaker Charles McCall and Pro Tem Greg Treat, both of who have termed out. It created a crime in the law called impermissible occupation. This is a immigration themed issue, right? And so at the time they basically said if someone is arrested for anything else or suspected of being in Oklahoma illegally, then they could be arrested and charged with this crime that they committed. This was not a crime before this. They just created this as a brand new crime because we need more of those around. And at the time, Joe Biden was still president, and so the Department of Justice under him objected to the law, as did a number of immigration groups, went to federal court, and federal court put a hold on it, and it's been kind of held up in the court since then. Well, we also had an election in November. We have a new president now and a new head of the DOJ. And so in March of this year, the DOJ said, just kidding, we no longer object to this law. Please proceed. Now, the other plaintiffs, the ACLU, the National Immigration Law Center, LULAC, and some others, were like, no, we still object. So they refiled a new challenge to this. And again, a federal court stepped in and said, okay, this law is on hold and blocks it from going into effect pending, additional review and hearings and legal outcomes. The law is pretty clear by my read, and I'm not a judge or an attorney, but it's simple enough that even I, a layperson, could understand that immigration is a federal responsibility, not a state responsibility, and that's because the U.S. Constitution grants the federal government the power to regulate immigration. And the Supreme Court has consistently upheld this power. There's a uniformity principle here that they say that the federal government should do this so that it is uniformly applied across all states so that we can maintain a national identity, right? Your immigration status is based on your national identity, not your state identity. And we don't want states having, some states where it's illegal to be there and other states where it's not. Like, this is a federal thing. And so I expect the court will kind of say, like, listen, this is a federal issue. Let's let them decide. Ironically, there was another bill this year that would have actually repealed this other bill, this House Bill 4156 from last year. The new bill didn't advance out of committee. I don't know why. Maybe they suspected or they expected that this one would be allowed to go into effect, even if it's not. As we near the end of session now, we're just a few days. Honestly, next week is sine die. They have to be done by next Friday. From what I've heard, they'll likely be done on Wednesday or Thursday. Monday, of course, is Memorial Day, so they won't be there. I expect they'll come back Tuesday, Wednesday, maybe to do any additional passage, maybe some veto overrides, and then they'll be done sometime Wednesday, Thursday, and get out of there. And they really do have until 5 p.m. on Thursday, on Friday to get done. And so we'll see what happens. But along the way, Governor Stitt has used his veto pen, it seems like, way more than in years past. Now, the data is still coming in, right? But there was a report this week about the number of times that he has used his veto pen. I think as of May 16th, so a week ago now, Governor Stitt had received 300-ish bills. No, he had vetoed 300-ish bills. He had received 253 bills and vetoed 39 of them, which is like 14%. And that is way higher. That's like more than twice as high as any other year. Now, I expect that number will shift a little bit because that doesn't include all of the budget bills. And there's like 54 budget bills plus some others that'll go to his desk, right? So by percentages, it will change a little bit. But he may also veto some, and we'll kind of see. I expect he might end up, I don't know, somewhere around 11, 12, 13%, like percentage veto. But still, the next highest is 7%, and that was 2 years ago. Last year was 6%, but KOSU did a report, or they looked at over the last 11 years. So basically, Governor Fallon's last term and then all of Stitt's two terms so far. And the average of those is like less than 5%. It's like around 3.5%. Some years, in 2021, Governor Stitt only vetoed like less than 2% of bills. It is unclear to me, really, why he's vetoed so many this year, other than like he's trying to make a statement about stuff. He's put out a lot of veto messages, sometimes on like reels on Instagram and Facebook, sometimes just with a written press release. And a lot of these have been weirdly slam dunks, like they weren't contentious in the legislature. Several of them passed almost unanimously out of both chambers, and he still vetoed them. You know, back on Missing and Murdered Indigenous Persons Day, he vetoed a bill dealing with missing and murdered Indigenous persons. It would have created a special unit just for that, because that's a big issue. And he's like, it's based on race. We don't really need it. He also rejected a bill that would have provided coverage for contrast-enhanced mammograms and breast imaging. I think we talked about that previously. Representative Provenzano has been running that for several years, and she herself is someone who has been undergoing treatment for breast cancer. That's a big one. Some of this, like, there was, he also vetoed a bill that would increase penalties for DUIs. A lot of these, A.G. Drummond has spoken up. Of course, he's running for governor, but he's spoken up and saying this is a bad deal. The governor, off the top of my head, also vetoed a bill dealing with 340B discount prescription prices. So we'll see. I will say, arguably, we're hoping that he vetoes at least one more bill, specifically Senate Bill 1027. If you receive our emails or follow us on social media, hopefully you saw my emails and social media posts about this yesterday. So this bill was passed by the legislature on Wednesday, went to the governor's office, so it's waiting for his signature or veto. Or he could do nothing, which is the same as a signature at this point. But Senate Bill 1027 deals with the initiative petition. And certainly you've heard lots of folks talk about this, not just me, but others. It is a bad bill, right? Oklahoma already has the most onerous initiative petition process in the entire country. We have the highest signature threshold, or the highest number of signatures required, and the shortest amount of time to collect it. We allow opponents twice as much time to challenge a bill as supporters do to collect signatures. You have two different summary paragraphs. The gist and the ballot title have different rules. I don't know why we have to write two different summaries when we could just write one that works for both. There's all these hurdles to jump through. And it's important to remember, right, the very first line, the first paragraph of the Bill of Rights in the Oklahoma Constitution are, all political power is inherent in the people, and government is instituted for their protection, security, and benefit, and to promote the general welfare, and the people have the right to alter or reform the same whenever the public good may require it. Right there, black and white. And it's been there since statehood, more than 100 years. Is the very first really right that's enumerated in the state constitution. Now, I know some people argue this bill can make it harder for everyone, both rural and urban, to bring issues forward. Yeah, and it would make it harder. I am one of those people who argues that it would make it harder. They have supporters of this, the legislature, including the speaker and the pro tem, have said this bill is about giving rural voters more of a voice. And I would push back on that and say there's ways you could do that without restricting things, right? Like you could increase the amount of time people have to collect signatures. Under the current law, supporters have to collect on average 2,000 signatures every single day for 90 days in order to have enough to get a measure on the ballot. 2,000 signatures a day. So you can just think about what it would take you to try to collect that many signatures. Where do you find 2,000 new people every single day? How many volunteers does it take you to get there? How can you best use your limited resources to get out there and get those signatures? You have to go to places that are densely populated. You can't just drive through Cimarron County and try to like knock doors when they live 5-10 miles apart from each neighbor, right? It's really hard. So rural counties tend to have fewer people sign petitions because there's fewer people in rural counties and because it's harder to get to them. That's why you see campaigns, you know, trying to collect signatures at the state fair or at county fairs, places where people gather. It's really hard work. You know what they could do? They could have extended the amount of time that a campaign has to maybe 180 days. And then you'd still need to collect 1,000 signatures a day, which is no small task. But it might give the opportunity for campaigns to have a little more bandwidth to get out there and do a better job of talking to voters in rural areas. But the real problem with Senate Bill 1027 is that it actually limits the number of signatures that a campaign can collect, not just statewide, but in each county. So the way the law is written is that you can't have more than a certain number of signatures for each county. It's based on a percentage of who voted in the last gubernatorial election. And it is different based on the size of the county. No, it's the same on the size of the county, but it's different based on if it's a statutory or constitutional change. But on average, only 6% of voters in each county would be allowed to sign a petition. 6% of registered voters. And we all know that Oklahoma has a really low voter turnout rate, even among registered voters. So it's hard to find people who like, you know, give a shit enough to sign a petition, even if they care about it, but they're just like, you know what? I don't want to sign it. I'll vote on it, but I don't want to sign it. That happens a lot. So as three examples, in Oklahoma County, there are about 452,000 registered voters. But under this law, only 25,000 could sign a petition. In other counties, it's worse. Harmon County, you could only have 78 people who are allowed to sign. In Cimarron County, out in the panhandle, only 84 people. So even if you went out there to collect signatures, which every campaign does, to be clear, every campaign goes to every county, because that's not because they have to, because it's the right thing to do, and you'd like to build as broad of a base of support as you can. But you're only allowed to collect that many signatures now. Well, okay, now we have disincentivized campaigns from going out there because they are only limited to a few. The bill also has some like requirements that people who collect signatures must be residents. That's unnecessary, in my opinion. That's how it happens anyway. I don't, there's not like a roving horde of signature collectors that like travel in a caravan of RVs from state to state. That's not, that would be a terrible job, and that's not what happens anyway. The people who collect signatures are the people who believe in it, who are going to be impacted by it, people from Oklahoma. You know who collected most of the signatures for minimum wage? People who will benefit from having a higher minimum wage. People who sign petitions for Medicaid expansion. People who were uninsured and couldn't get access to insurance without expansion of Medicaid. You know who signed petitions for medical marijuana? People who wanted medical marijuana in our state. And not just signed, but who carried it, right? These are massive volunteer efforts. It's really hard. Campaigns do often pay people because you want to, even volunteers, people who say like, hey, I'll do it for you. It's like, great. I would like to compensate you for your time. It's a great job for college students. It's also a really helpful job for people who need a little extra money. People who are working, you know, two or three jobs already, if they have the opportunity for a few weeks to make even a few hundred dollars, they'll do it because it's the right thing to do. And that's, I was thinking about this the other day, and it really occurred to me that initiative petitions are good for business. And that means that this bill, Senate Bill 1027, is bad for business. That's a job killer. You know, a typical ballot initiative campaign is going to cost 5 to 10 million, maybe 15 million in Oklahoma for most issues. And that means all of that money is going directly into our local economy, right? Like, that's tens of millions of dollars going into our local economy. Each campaign creates hundreds of jobs. You know, tons of money going into small businesses. Maybe it's small local newspapers that are struggling already. Maybe it's restaurants that are catering events or providing snacks for volunteers. Local print shops, small businesses that do like merch, that stickers and t-shirts and all that kind of stuff. Even just like fuel, gasoline, right? Like when I ran People Not Politicians, which was a statewide ballot campaign in 2019 and 2020, that first year, I put nearly 20,000 miles on my car, which is about $2,500 in gasoline costs that I paid, right? Out of my pocket. That was money going into small businesses who, you know, small business owners who own these like rural gas stations. That doesn't even include the like snacks that I bought out there. It doesn't include the restaurants we ate at when we were doing campaign stops. It also doesn't even account for like the fuel tax that is part of that, right? Every gallon of gasoline we buy includes a fuel tax that goes to the state that helps the state budget. And so, like it or not, like whether you support a particular issue or not, ballot initiatives are good for business. If we had more ballot initiatives, it would increase voter turnout because they would have more opportunities to use their voice, and it would be more money coming into our state's economy. And honestly, this is part of like a coordinated attack across states. So I, last week and then 2 weeks before that, I was with colleagues from Arkansas and Missouri and Florida, all of which are fighting bills very similar to this. It is very clear that whoever is behind all of this is kind of working together. The attacks are very similar. There's only 26 states that have the initiative petition in the first place. Almost all of them, Florida is an outlier because it's on the East Coast. All the rest of them are in the middle of the country, like us, Arkansas, Missouri, Kansas, and then going west, like Mountain West region, like Idaho, South Dakota, and then in the West Coast, right? California, and Colorado, places like that. And that's because when Americans were like settling this continent, right, as we were migrating across the continent from east to west and founding new states, there was this trend of like, you could see the founders moving away from the East Coast saying, I'm sick of being under the thumb of some sort of elitist, protectionist, you know, ruling class of politicians who often have different incentives that make them unable or unwilling to do the will of the people, right? And so they recognize there was a need at some points in our history for the people, for you and I, to have an opportunity to self-govern, right? To pass laws or amendments to the Constitution because it's what we need. And that's how our Constitution reads, right? That when the public good may require it. And that's exactly why we have it. Some of the opponents will argue about, you know, are we a Republican form of government or a democracy, a republic or a democracy? And the truth is, we're a democratic republic. Our arrangement of our government is a republic where we elect people to represent us. That is true. No one has a problem with that. And also, in many states, we have this other piece, right, that is a direct democracy component, because the founders of our state and many other states recognized, hey, a republic is not enough, right? We cannot put all of our trust in our politicians, and with good reason, right? I saw some polling recently that Oklahoma voters trust voters to do the right thing twice as much as they trust the state legislature, right? It was like 26-28% of people say they trust the legislature, and closer to 60% of people who trust voters to do the right thing. And I think when you look back at the state questions that have passed and those that have failed, you can see the ones that were like, if someone's trying to pull the wool over the eyes of Oklahoma voters, they vote no. It really takes an earnest, authentic campaign to win. And I love that voters can kind of see through the political, you know, cloudiness of some of these folks trying to do things. So this bill, Senate Bill 1027, if it does anything, it restricts Oklahoma voters' like free speech, right? If it limits the number of people who could sign a petition. The other day, I recorded a interview on OETA. It'll air Friday night and Saturday night and Sunday afternoon. And if you follow us, I'll send the link out as soon as I have it. But it was me and Speaker Hilbert, and we were talking about this bill. And he said, you know, that a campaign could collect as many signatures that they want. And maybe they could. But if you know that you've collected more than what you really than you're allowed in a certain county, the rest of those don't matter. They get thrown out. Right. And that means that those people who stood up, maybe waited in line, who took the time to say, I want to put my name on this petition because I believe in this. It is tantamount to saying it doesn't matter. Your voice doesn't matter. Imagine if we just threw out votes in the same way, right? That would be blatantly unconstitutional. I argue this is the same principle. It is not signatures or not votes, to be clear. And every voter in Oklahoma gets the chance to vote on every state question when it appears in the ballot. It doesn't matter if all the signatures came from rural counties or from urban counties or whatever. Every voter has a chance to actually vote on it. That's the part that is most important. So we'll see what happens. My ask to you, friends, is that this bill is on the governor's desk right now, waiting him to decide if it lives on or if it dies today. Please take the time to send a note to the governor asking him to veto it. If you're not sure where to start, go to our website, letsfixthis.org. And click on the tab at the top that says get involved and then action alerts. You can also just go to letsfixthis.org/action, and it's the top one. Tell Governor Sitt to veto 1027. Use it's a really easy form. Send him a note. Tell him this is bad for democracy. It's bad for business. It's bad for Oklahoma. Please do that. All right, a few other notes, I think, that are worth talking about before we wrap up. One is a really impactful bit of news that came out yesterday. The U.S. Supreme Court, SCOTUS, as we like to call it, didn't rule. I guess that's the note. They didn't actually rule. They put out a note that basically said, we're not going to rule on this, about the St. Isidore of Seville case, right? So this one we've talked about before. It went to the Supreme Court last year, I guess. St. Isidore would be it's a Catholic charter school that they were seeking to open to offer a government-funded online education to students in the state. But it would have also taught Catholic doctrine, and operated according to church teaching. So essentially, it would have been the first publicly funded, openly religious charter school in the country, right? And they did this on purpose, right? They're trying to get this before the Supreme Court. It's also weird to me. It's not even a real school. It's a virtual school. And maybe I'm going to, you know, get hate mail for saying it's not a real school, but it is not a building. It is a online school that teaches Catholic doctrine and also happens to teach like math and science and reading. Also, it's run by the Catholic Church, which is the wealthiest church in the history of the world. I don't understand why they need public money to run an online school. They could do that on their own if they really wanted to. Back in 2023, the Oklahoma Statewide Virtual Charter School Board, which oversees virtual charter schools, approved this, the application. AG Gittner Drummond at the time asked the state Supreme Court to intervene and like filed a lawsuit against it. The Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court said, oh yeah, this violates the principle of non-sectarianism. So that you basically says you can't, the state constitution says you can't give public dollars to sectarian or religious organizations that way. And so it got appealed up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And it was a 4-4 decision, right? Four in favor, four opposed. There are 9 members on the court, you may recall. Justice Amy Comey Barrett recused herself because she had previously represented Notre Dame in a lawsuit and had some connection there. And so she was like, no, I've got a conflict of interest. Well, she was a faculty member, I guess, at Notre Dame. And then she had also worked with Catholic officials' case for the school. And so because of that, she said, no, I'm just not going to participate. I'm going to recuse myself. And that meant that that left 8 members evenly divided. But they didn't say who was on which side. It was like a 1-page ruling, not even a ruling, a 1-page statement that said simply, it's a hung court. We're not going to rule. The lower court holds, which is how it works. So a big victory for separation of church and state and for upholding that principle. Is this settled? No. No. It is likely that we will see a similar case, perhaps in another state, rise up next year, the year after, sometime soon, right? A religious organization will attempt to create a religious school funded by state dollars. I wouldn't be surprised if it happens in Florida or Texas. They will figure out where they think they have the best shot. Like they can try to shop around for the most hospitable judge to get it up, get in front of. It'll get appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they'll do it in a way where perhaps none of the justices on SCOTUS will have a conflict. And that might mean that someone like Amy Comey Barrett ends up being the deciding vote on this issue. It's very interesting that they didn't do it this year. I think we'll all be watching to see where it happens next. But for now, I am relieved. It is a victory that we can celebrate together. The separation of church and state is maintained, at least for another year. I mentioned earlier that next week is the sine die. We will see what happens Tuesday and Wednesday with veto overrides. Hopefully, they come back and override some vetoes. We'll see what happens with Senate Bill 1027. Again, please sign our form. Go to letsfixthis.org/action. Looking at the data now, we've already had almost 200 people submit. That's a little over 200 that have submitted some an online effort to call for action on this. Thank you to all, I didn't do the math, 250-ish of you who have done that. Please, we need more. We need thousands. So after you do it, share it with your friends. Tell people, send it around. Let people know that this is worthwhile. Because, man, once we lose our right and our ability to petition our government, it's going to be real hard to get it back. Really hard, really expensive. Regardless of the outcome, whether the governor signs it or not, I'll tell you what, friends, what we need to do is we need to get together and we need to rewrite the state constitution in a way that creates a firm protections around the initiative petition so that the legislature cannot touch it. And then we need to run that, an initiative petition about initiative petitions. And then we need you to volunteer, right? We need to prove to them that Oklahomans, as we have done time and time again through our state's history, Oklahomans do not take kindly to politicians taking away our power, and we're willing to do what we need to do to stand up and put walls around that right in the Constitution so that they cannot keep eroding this. It is not just on principle, but in practice, way too difficult, way too expensive. This is not at all what the framers of our state constitution had in mind. It is not useful to the people in the way that it's supposed to be. And without it, we lose this really important like check and balance on what's happening in our with our state government. And if we lose that, man, then the politicians can run wild, right? I would also argue that the initiative petition is helpful to the legislature. It gets framed as something that is oppositional to them, but that's not always the case. There are plenty of times Medicaid expansion was debated for almost 10, I mean, for years and years through the legislature, and it was passed by both chambers and sent to the governor. The reason it didn't pass then is the governor vetoed it. So when the legislature says like, oh, well, this passed and the people didn't want it, y'all passed it too, man, right? The only reason it wasn't lost because the governor is the one who vetoed it. And you didn't have the votes to come back and override the veto. There are times, right, where there is an issue that lawmakers believe in but don't want to vote on because they want to get reelected. I know a lot of Republican lawmakers who are supportive of abortion rights but would never say so publicly, right? A lot of Republican lawmakers who are supportive of open primaries or increasing the minimum wage but would never vote on it publicly because they don't want to be on the record because they want to run they want to get reelected. The initiative petition allows us to get those bills passed because they know the people want it. And it allows us politicians to kind of stay out of it, right? In the shadows. And so any politician who's like, oh, well, you know, we need this because we should get rid of this because we don't like people passing their own laws. No, listen, you guys propose 3,000 bills a year. Let us get one every couple of years, right? Let us help you. Let us work with you side by side. This way you don't have to be the one to do it. The legislature clearly didn't want to raise the minimum wage. They debated against it several times. Okay, well, now it's on the ballot, right? And when it passes, you guys can act like you're upset about it, or you can just be quiet and recognize that the people did what they wanted to do, what they needed to do for the betterment of our state. All right. Well, friends, that's it for this week. This weekend is Memorial Day weekend. I hope you find a cookout somewhere. Here in Oklahoma City, the Paseo Arts Festival is happening. It's going to be hot and potentially rainy, like it is every year for the Paseo Arts Festival. I hope to see many of you there or out in the community. Take a few days. You got a 3-day weekend, folks. Just take a deep breath and relax. Enjoy the nice weather. Hug your family, hug your kids, and begin thinking about how you are going to show up for your community this summer, right? Once session's over, it feels like people think, oh, okay, things are done. They're not done, right? The State Board of Education continues its war path, although that might change. They've got a new board member now, and maybe the balance of power has shifted. But we're going to start moving into campaign season for 2026, really hardcore. There's already 6 candidates for governor out there, some candidates for lieutenant governor, for AG. You're going to start seeing more from them online and out in the community. Lots of community festivals, and a lot of our partners need you to start talking to voters too, right? Whenever candidates ramp up their efforts to talk to voters, I want to make sure that the nonprofit community is also doing our part to talk to voters, not about candidates, but about issues and about reminding people that we need to come together because we are way stronger together than we are when we're separate. If you'd like to get involved with that, 2 recommendations. LULAC is one. They're a Latino-led organization on the south side of Oklahoma City. They're going to start doing community walks I believe next weekend, the 1st of June. That's a great organization to get involved with, particularly if you're Spanish speaking or of Latino heritage. They need folks from the community to help with that. In Oklahoma City, Foundation for Liberating Minds has been doing a program called We the East Side, where they're knocking doors on the east side of Oklahoma City, although they're looking to expand to other areas. They're great. They're super sharp. They've got a great kind of training program that's real simple. It's all like app-based on your phone. It's really easy to do. We work with them, help provide some of that technology for them to use. If you're in Tulsa, the Terrence Crutcher Foundation has been doing community walks for years. I guarantee they would love to have more volunteers help with that. Voter registration drives are happening around the state. If you're interested in doing that and you're not already involved and you just want to start doing one, send us an email, info@letsfixthis.org. I will happily create you a voter reg kit with training materials, all the forms you need, you know, pins, tape, signs, whatever, and we'll get you hooked up so you can do voter registration in your community as well. We'll be back next week with a Sign and Die episode, and then probably a couple more before the end of June, and then we'll take a break this summer, I think. And so we need to kind of recalibrate what we're doing and find out or make some decisions on how this podcast can be most useful. So maybe that's my last ask as the music plays and we wrap up for today. Can you send me a quick email? Can you tell me how long you've been listening and what you get out of Let's Pod This? We're approaching episode 300, and it's a good chance to reflect and to refine what we do for the current environment and for what's happening for 2026. So let me know how we can be most useful to you listeners as we kind of strategize for the future. Thanks. And as we go, remember that decisions are made by those who show up. We'll see you out there.